This episode is brought to you by Habit Aware. My Keen 2 brings awareness to my trichotillomania by giving my wrist a gentle hug or vibration when I'm doing the scanning behavior. Bring awareness into your life by visiting barbaralally.com/habitaware and use code LALLYLOVE for 10% off.
Barbara, it's so great to be here, first of all. And I'll confess that I've actually never talked about this on a podcast. So this is my first sort of live in person, so to speak, over the great internet conversation about this. So my BFRB is trichotillomania, which is compulsive hair pulling. And mine showed up when I was a preschooler in two sort of very specific moments. The first is I remember very clearly that my grandmother, Lumen, my paternal grandmother, took me to get a Sears portrait done back in the day when we used to go to the department store and get our family portraits or our individual portraits made. And I was 4 years old, and she dressed me in this very cute red dress with little white flowers on it. And she had the photographer sort of position me in a very purposeful way to hide my compulsive hair pulling, because in my case, my BFRB only showed up on one side of my head. So it was not symmetrical. It was on the right side of my head. And mine looks like sort of what I call a half mullet. So when I pull, I do what's called a twist pop pull, and I break my hair off at about the 1 inch mark. And so there is very specific photographic evidence of me at age 4 with this beautiful, I say that tongue in cheek, half mullet at the Sears Portrait Studio, where it's very clear that I have long hair on one side and about an inch of hair or a couple of inches of hair on the other side. And my blessed grandmother, who helped me pose for this photograph, was like trying to side sweep my hair, you know, and make it look like it was very purposeful. But I think she and I both knew that this was definitely a habit, a compulsion. And she was doing her best sort of to make me feel pretty amid this hair disaster. And so for me, it started at a very young age, and it has consistently remained that way. Always the right side of my head, always the half mullet, always about an inch of hair remaining, and always an effort to sort of side sweep to the other side. Another note about my BFRB is that I am left-handed. And so the right side was very purposeful, I think, for my own body-brain connection, because even in school, when I was learning to write with a pencil on the left side, I could twist, pop, pull on the right side and watch the hair sort of fall down in my lap in a very satisfying way, which I know we'll get into the mechanics of all this. And you were very open and honest about what yours looks like in particular, even like adding the hair across your lip. But mine was always twist, pop, pull, break the hair off, let it fall down to my lap. And then if I was trying really hard not to pull, I might, and I do this even some today, do a twist and then also fold it over so that I've got a little piece that I can feel, because you talk so much about tactile. And for me, that was what it was about too, is getting the smoothness of that hair, the way it feels when it's in a half fold right before I can twist and pop and pull it. So that's my BFRB.
And you mentioned your grandmother knew. I mean, people around you knew and would try to pose you different ways and try to cover it up. What was their reaction, if you remember, to finding it maybe for the first time?
Oh, it was always fix it. You know, Dana, you know, slapping my hand away. Dana, put your hand down. Ladies, don't do that. That's not ladylike. So it was always fixing it. My mother at a young age cut my hair into what's called a Dorothy Hamill, which is kind of a bowl cut. My dad cut it first with homemade paper scissors. And then my mom took me to a stylist to have it properly cut. And so my mother always made me keep short hair. And my mother also began perming my hair to change the texture texture of my hair to try to see if it weren't straight, would it stop sort of that repetitive behavior? But in my family, it was always a negative and always something that should be stopped, something that was disgusting, that was unladylike and uncouth. And so the only person that really was very kind to me about it, I'm gonna start crying when I talk about it, is my cousin, Doggy, in between two trailers, my book, Cousin Erin, who is a stylist in Bloomington, Indiana. She works at Ruby Salon in Bloomington. And when she became a stylist later in life, she was always sympathetic, but when she became a stylist later in life, she would always reassure me and tell me, you know, when she would cut my hair or style my hair or dye my hair or color my hair, she would always massage and smooth it and reassure me that, oh, Dana, you have no idea how many clients I see who are also struggling with this. You know, I see hair pulling all the time and it's okay. I can cut it and layer it and style it in such a way that, you know, you won't even notice it and no one else will notice it either. So sort of two very different reactions from the older women in my life and then one of my contemporaries, my cousin who is my age, who was very sympathetic and understanding towards my BFRB.
At what point did you find out there was a name for this behavior?
Oh, you know, I think you were the one that actually taught me that. I think I found it in a psychological text at some time, and then I found out the label of it, but you were the one that taught me that the BFRB part. I had learned the trichotillomania part a bit earlier when I just Googled it for solutions, but I didn't, you were the first to sort of bring it to my attention and the first person I've ever met who talked publicly about it and showed, you know, talked about your process and showed pictures and showed progress and talked about what it's like and the feeling that you get when you're getting ready to pull and how exhilarating that can be. But it was really you that taught me a lot about trichotillomania and BFRB.
That's so cool because I remember us meeting, very early on in Instagram. I mean, pre-pandemic, like
Yes.
I was still like kind of private then. So I'm just so happy to hear that because, it was a lot of writing without the pictures at first and then slowly
Right.
getting that courage. It's wonderful to hear because I did feel, in my journey, yeah, I took baby steps to get where I am now, where I can make those videos and show everything. But yeah, thank you so much.
Yes, I remember that distinctly, that your first posts were the beautiful graphic design, you know, the flowers with the black flowers and the beautiful sort of wreath design. And I do remember that you didn't show pictures at first, but I remember thinking this person is so courageous to even bring it to people's attention that it exists because there's so much shame around it. And so much kind of yuck factor. People are like, oh, why would you do that? Or why, you know, if you're a trickster who likes to put your hair in your mouth or swallow your hair, people are like, oh, that's gross. You know, so people, there was so much stigma around it. It was really hard to find a community where it felt safe to talk about it. And for me, you were the first person that made that safety and that space. And it was online, which just goes to show you the power of being connected in community through the internet.
Well, now you're gonna have me start crying. So let me reel this in, or let me reel this in because I'm gonna get emotional here.
Oh, I love it. Let's get emotional. It's all the things all the time.
Oh yeah, you see me getting red? You see this? You see this?
Yes.
What were some of the things that you tried growing up
Oh.
to manage your BFRB?
Yeah. And you know, and both of us have already gotten emotional, you know, just in this short time. And that speaks to it. Like that speaks to the power of this BFRB. Like it's just any BFRB, right? But especially this one because hair is so visible, right? Especially for women, but of course for men too. But it's the idea that young girls in particular are supposed to have nice hair. We're supposed to take care of our hair and we're supposed to style it and wash it and make it look pretty and not mess with it once it's done, you know? It's like, and so that was really the solution, beginning with my mother, you know, the perms at a young age, the Dorothy Hamill haircut. And then one thing that I realized, especially growing up as a poor kid, was that if I spent money on my hair, let's say my mother getting it permed, or later in college when I would dye it blonde, I was less likely to pull it because I felt like I had made an investment of money or someone else had invested their money and time in me. And so I felt really guilty for sort of wasting that time and money. Now, that didn't last long, right? Because the BFRBs are so powerful, but certainly cutting my hair, dyeing my hair. Let's see, I would also, and a lot of BFRBs do this, and I hope we'll talk about this. I would switch to another BFRB, which for me is the dermatillomania. So I would start with the cuticles and, have bloody sort of picked spots on all of my fingers, nail biting. So I think sometimes a BFRBs can be a bit of a whack-a-mole, right? You try one thing. It doesn't work, or you trade one habit for another. And so that's really what mine look like. And I'm 43 and I've had it, since I was a preschooler. And I don't think I'll ever fully be rid of it, but I do think that for me, it comes in cycles. And so I know that like I haven't done hair pulling for a couple of years since the pandemic, early pandemic. I went back to hair pulling like in really intense ways, probably many of us did. But I've noticed just in the past couple of months, even this morning when I was journaling, I'll start the twist, of, ooh, this feels so good to like twist my hair and like rub it. And oh, but then I'll like start, I know exactly where I need to go to start that like pop, right? Like if I were doing it right now, I could pop it, but I know, oh, you're getting ready to pop it. So just stop right there, let go, and then do something to occupy your right hand. So sometimes that's fiddling with something tactile. It might be putting a pin in my hand so that I don't, that right hand is occupied because remember I'm left-handed, or something so that my right hand is not free for me to pop my hair.
I meant to tell you this. I'm the opposite. I am right-handed, and so everything's left, but I will not, I have tried to pull and make it symmetrical. I've tried on the other side,
Other
and it
side.
doesn't feel the same. There's something special about that side of the head that I only go on the other side. I don't go on both sides. I just go on the left for my whole life.
You're exactly right. Like I'm trying it just to see what it feels like on my left side, and it doesn't have the same, you're right. It doesn't, it's not the same satisfaction, is it? But that's a really interesting, and I don't know how, if anyone has done research on this, if BFRBs tend to be on the non-dominant side or the non-dominant hand. Have you read anything or seen anything published in an article?
I haven't seen anything like published. However, just from talking to others, it does seem that way. It seems like, oh, this one's free. What else can it do? This
This
is perfect.
totally. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? And one thing, and I am curious, and I don't remember from blogs or posts. So if you posted about this and I don't know it, I'm sorry, I don't know it. One thing I've always been curious about is, and I've never done it, but I've thought about doing it and I've tried to like finagle ways into making it a possibility, is shaving my head completely and just kind of starting from scratch with like fresh baby hair. To see what would happen. Have you ever done that? Like just a total head shave complete?
I haven't, but I've spoken to a ton of people that have. And I'll tell you what, 90% of those people, the second they shaved everything off, it was like a breath of fresh air. They said they felt freedom they never had before. The only downside that they said was because it was, they went very short and they had like weeks and weeks, because your hair only grows like what, half an inch a month. But they went, about a month without being able to grip this. The hair. So they were like, oh, I'm free. But then once it grows back and you can grip it, they would shave it again. So some people feel like, once you start that you continue to do it because you want that relief. And so it's kind of a maintain of the shave. Other people, they do end up growing their hair out completely again. But yeah, it's just so interesting that they'd say, I've never felt freedom like this. It's been this many years. And that was the first time I felt it.
Whoa, that is incredible. Wow, what a relief that would feel like, you know? Oh, but then it does sound like within weeks or months, you're sort of the hair is back enough to grip, and you do have that temptation that returns, unfortunately. But it's interesting for folks who feel like they can, pull off shaved hair, for the rest of their lifetimes if they want to, that would be an interesting option for people.
And they also mention beauty and being feminine. It's like this long, beautiful hair. And when they shave it, they're like, oh, I actually am more beautiful this way. Like I found beauty in myself now versus trying to hold on to the hair that I did have. Once I shaved it, one, I took my trichotillomania mania in control. Like I took control of it by making the step. But also now I took control of how I view myself. I do feel beautiful now, no matter what. So it's a really great, I mean, people love it. And so it's inspirational to hear.
Yeah, that is inspirational. It really is. And the beauty standards are changing, and that's a relief. And things aren't as binary either, you know? Women don't have to have what used to be the female beauty standards of long hair. So yeah, that's fascinating to me.
So you mentioned you have other BFRBs. When did
Yes.
they develop?
The nail biting definitely in high school. Nail biting in high school, and then the cuticle ripping in college. So chewing, and then like if I have a little piece of skin, I've got to rip it off, and then it'll bleed, of course. And what I do, this is, well, maybe not great advice for people, but my tolerance for hydrogen peroxide, my pain tolerance is really high. I can take a lot of sting on an open sore. And so what I will do now is in my cuticle pulling or my skin pulling, I will just douse myself in hydrogen peroxide to try to dry out and heal up those wounds very quickly. Remind me if you've got dermatillomania as well.
In high school, I definitely had
Okay.
it pretty strong, but
Yeah.
not as an adult. But sometimes, you know, you see something, you start going down the rabbit hole.
Right, exactly. So nail biting high school, yes, and then cuticle pulling still, I've got that. In fact, the only way I can cope with that, because I'm not hair pulling right now, is if I polish my nails and have them look pretty. Again, there's this, like something about investing time and energy in hair or nails that like I don't want to mess it up, you know? Like that's kind of how I feel, but it's really hard to keep up with all that stuff. It's hard to color your hair or perm your hair or straighten your hair, whatever it is, and buy products and polish your nails. And so I don't keep up with it. I just learn to use, I can tolerate a lot of pain on my fingertips. And then my other one is also nail clipping. So I will get to a point too where my nails are like, even if they're short, they're still driving me crazy. And so I will compulsively clip them with nail clippers as well as my toenails as well, and clip them way too short down to the quick. And so it's almost too, this is a feeling I think a lot of BFRB folk understand. There's something too inherent in that pain of cutting down to the quick or ripping the skin off your cuticles or even pulling your hair out at the scalp. You know, there's something about that pain. This sounds very bizarre, that is a huge relief for us, those of us who have the BFRBs. So yes, cuticles, nail biting, nail cutting, and then the trichotillomania.
Is there one that you would say plagued you more? You know, one that you were like, this is the worst one.
The trick is definitely the worst. It's in terms of years, you know, decades, really. I think the trick is the worst. Medically, the dermatillomania is the most dangerous, right? Because you can easily get skin infections from pulling at your cuticles, which is why I use so much hydrogen peroxide. And those skin infections are, you know, will go to the bloodstream quickly if you leave them untreated. And so that's definitely the most dangerous. I mean, hair pulling, it's not going to cause an infection unless you're also a scalp picker, right? Some people are. My mother had the scalp picking BFRB. So she was actually a scalp scab and bleed and had special medication for hers. And so, in a way, I guess it is a bit hereditary, or at least a learned habit from an adult. But definitely the fingers, the bleeding of the fingers and pulling back the cuticles is the most dangerous just because of infection. Trichotillomania, if you're pulling at the scalp, yes, maybe your hair, you're going to damage your hair follicle. I mean, you and I know that, and the hair is not going to grow back as well. But in terms of an infection, unless you break the skin, right, it's not necessarily dangerous.
I noticed in my experience, my trichotillomania, and you also touched on this, it comes in cycles. You know, sometimes it's very, very intense. Can you tell us a little
Yeah.
about those moments where it wasn't as intense? You know, things were growing back.
Yeah, post-pandemic, I had about a couple of inches on my right side, and I got the first haircut I got out of the pandemic. I said, you know what? I just need to get this under control, which we haven't even talked about stylists. I hate going to get my hair cut. Maybe you do too. Do you like it going to get your hair done, Barbara? How do you feel about that?
Well, I have a girl that I love, so I like it now. But,
Oh.
not having someone that you like, I mean, I would avoid it. I don't want to go. They're going to judge me and be weird.
Yeah, that's it. They're going to judge and be weird. Yes. And so my cousin Doggy lives in Bloomington, Indiana. So I always tell her, if I were a rich person, I would, fly to see you every 6 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever and have you do my hair religiously. But obviously, I can't do that. But yeah, it's the more stress I have in my life, there's an uptick. And maybe that correlates with you as well. And I also found that when writing Between Two Trailers, my memoir, which is about trauma, it's a trauma-informed memoir. When I was home off book tour, which was not that long ago, I felt very re-traumatized. I felt very emotionally vulnerable, had a vulnerability hangover. And I noticed that that's when I started reaching again for my hair and did a couple of pop pulls, twist pop pulls. I call it like my Rice Krispie treats move, twist pop pull. But it does come and go. And for me, it always correlates with stress and trauma. Have you found that to be true with yours?
Yes, and I've also noticed sometimes it could be anything. Like I could be really excited and happy and like I'm anxious but in a good way for something and I'm still doing it. So even like too much of a positive emotion will get me too and I'm like, "Hey, wait a minute."
Wow, that's so well said. It's like the energy, the release of it provides relief even from anxiety, from exciting things.
Do you fall into what I like to call the trick trance? And if you do, can you explain to us what it feels like for you?
Yeah, my understanding of the trick trance is this zone. I should ask you how you would define that first. So how do you define the trick trance?
So for me, it's like I'm out of body. It's this hyper
Yes.
fixation. There could be loud music playing, but I won't hear it. It's like I'm in my own world and I could be there for 2 hours and it feels like 2 minutes.
Yes. It's like a disassociation where you sort of leave your environment, leave your sort of body right here and sort of turn inward. Yes, totally. And I will, when I was writing the book, when I was writing Between Two Trailers, I was typing, right? Which is a huge benefit because then you're occupying both hands. But if I were to pause and read something out of a book or go to look up something or go through photographs or something like that, I would notice that I would start hair pulling. And what happens for me is that I don't understand or realize I'm in the trance until I look down at where I'm sitting and I see the pile of hair. Is that true for you?
Yes. And then after it's like, oh no. Well, before I
Oh,
used to do an
no.
oh no. Now I'm a little bit
Yes.
nicer, but that oh no, I could feel the knot in my stomach right now.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. And one of the things I love about your approach is encouraging people to think about not the fact that they have to get rid of it, right? Like, oh, just absolutely, you can't do it again for the rest of your life, but to consider and to be observant and to learn from your own BFRB about what is it teaching you? What is it telling you about your emotions, your nervous system, your trauma, your triggers, all of that. And I really like that approach because it eliminates that shame factor of when you look down at your lap, at your right thigh, right? And there's this huge pile of hair, and you do have a moment of, oh crap, right? Oh no, what have I done? Because the thing about hair is that, like, you can't like go in the next room and magically have it appear unless you invest in wigs, which we haven't even talked about. Wigs are hair pieces. And so, yeah, then it's like, oh, it's happened. The trance has come and gone, and this is what I'm left with.
What are some ways that you try to cover up your short pieces or missing areas?
When I was a kid, I would take my mother's slips, and a slip is like an undergarment. And I say that because so many of my students who are, 17 to 24 have no idea what a slip is or an undergarment, but it's something we used to wear back in the 80s and 90s underneath our skirts so that you couldn't see our underwear. And so I would take my mother's slips and put it kind of over my head. And then I would take rubber bands, our fancy little rubber bands that we used to have in the 80s, which were like an elastic band, but it had two pieces of glass that you could fasten together. And it made this cute little rubber band with like some little color in your hair. And I would make a ponytail with that slip, and then I would put those rubber bands all down the ponytail, and I would pretend that that was my hair, and so it would cover up my trick, and it was a way of like almost wearing a wig and using it to cover up. Sometimes I wear hats too, not really often, like in a day-to-day, usually if I'm just outside working, but the slip for sure. I've thought about getting hair pieces and wigs, but I haven't really had the courage to pull the trigger on that. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's I'm worried that it would not look authentic on me, right? Or it would be more noticeable, if that makes sense. It would draw more scrutiny and attention to it. Not that wearing a like a bright white cream colored slip on your head when you're six doesn't draw attention to you, you know? I remember people coming over to our trailer and being like, "What are you wearing on your head? Like, what is this silk slip that this little kid has on?" But yeah, it's those are the two that come to mind in particular, are those the slip and then occasionally a hat. But tell me sort of your philosophy on wigs and hair pieces to cover up. What's your current philosophy?
I think it's always best to do what's going to make you feel better, right? So, like my experiences, I did wear extensions. I had ones that were clip-ins that were synthetic. I had sew-ins, which were real human hair. And at the time, it's like what I needed to feel comfortable in my skin. And so, it's always what's best for you. Like some people will, shave their hair and they'll have missing patches and they'll just enter the world like that. And that's what makes them feel good. If a wig's going to make you feel good, I think, definitely get it.
It's so interesting to consider. Like, and it's good to try things. I mean, a wig is obviously a huge investment, except for the one you get down at the Halloween store, in a couple of months. That's a cheap investment. But otherwise, I know they're very expensive, as are many extensions and that kind of thing too. But that's a good advice. Just do what makes you feel like you can be comfortable entering the world. I like that a lot.
Did you know Habit Aware also offers virtual peer coaching? This one-to-one peer-based program will coach you through shifting mindset, practicing healthy strategies, and creating your personal roadmap to recovery. To work with me, Ellen, or Anila, head over to habitaware.com/coaching today. When we have our BFRB and it's showing and it's kind of obvious and we have that oh no moment, we do sometimes feel like, okay, there are things I have to do before I leave the house. There's this pressure of, okay, I have to have my hair a certain way, this way, this way. How did you handle kind of that extra layer? Not only is it the hair pulling, it's much more. It's the people noticing, it's everything.
Oh gosh, I'm getting so tearful because I've never had anyone ask me these questions. Like, it's kind of blowing my mind, Barbara. It feels very ex I feel very accepted, and you're encouraging sort of my self-love of in myself to talk about all this, because you're also helping me realize that I do a lot surrounding this condition that I don't even think about, you know? And so, to answer your question, when I was in college and I had really short hair, but I was still pulling, I would pull my hair up into a very, very high, like tight ponytail up in the top, like a whale spout. I didn't have enough to make it a full ponytail, but it would be just be this little whale spout that I had right here. And I went to a girls' school, so there wasn't a lot of pressure. There weren't men in our classrooms that we were dressing up for, any of those like kind of wild early 2000s standards of impressing the opposite sex. But I would pull it up into a whale spout, and my teachers would be like, "What in the world do you have on the top of your head coming to class with this whale spout?" But I kind of ignored it because I knew, it hid the fact that I only had about an inch of hair, and I pulled it so tight, almost like if you were to have bangs, it would just be a ponytail for your bangs, you know? And so that's when I started. I do have some pictures of college of the whale spout. And so that was a don't leave the house or don't leave your dorm room without the whale spout. And then nowadays, my husband discourages it because he's like, "I love your hair. You just wear it down. You wear it however you want to." But I like to wear my hair in a very high ponytail, like a super high ponytail, and then twist it into a bun for two reasons. If I have a short piece, it hides it, right? Because it's still a pretty high ponytail. And then also because it's pulled back, when I enter out into the world or go anywhere, you can't see if I've got different length strands of hair. And so Barbara, it didn't even occur to me that those are two things that I do to prep myself to be out in the world with this BFRB. So it's very emotional talking about it, but gosh, like I said, I've never really talked about these things out loud. And so woo, you're giving me all kinds of freedom. I feel like I've got a shaved head now, you know? Like you're giving me the freedom to name all these things for myself. But those are my two, the whale spout and then the high ponytail with the bun.
Because I think so many times we hear, oh, just stop, or oh, hair pulling, you could
Yes.
stop that. And it's like, it's not just that. It's so much heavier than I think
Oh.
people realize, and especially because we're very little and we don't have the
Yes.
emotional capacity or the emotional intelligence to deal with it. It's
Right.
so hard. It's so hard.
It's so hard. Yes. It's like tell when people say, "Oh, you can stop smoking," right? I'm not a smoker, but it's really hard to quit smoking after you've been doing it for decades. And when you're a kid, you're right. Like if a kid started, you don't smoke, little kid. Well, the kid doesn't have the wherewithal to figure out that they're even like smoking, right? Or even have a habit that's not acceptable in society. You know, and all this is there's so many like societal norms and standards and what hair should look like and what skin should look like that are all woven into this, in addition to very complex hurt, pain, trauma, emotions that led to us beginning to use the BFRB in the first place. Because my understanding is that a BFRB is a coping mechanism. You know, it is what we used to call a maladaptive coping mechanism, although I think sort of we changed that language now to unhealthy coping mechanism versus healthy coping mechanism. So, yeah, you're right. You're 100% right. There's so much behind the BFRB that people can't see on the surface. And so it's unfair to ask someone to just stop because it's not that simple.
Has your BFRB ever led you to avoid things? Like you felt like you couldn't attend certain events because of it?
Great question too. I haven't avoided, well, I avoid going to get my hair cut. Yes, I guess I do avoid. I avoid getting my hair cut. I hate getting my hair cut unless cousin doggy is doing it. I don't get my hair colored. I'm going gray a bit, but I don't care. I'm like, I'm not going to somebody just to hear them. You know, because I the people I have found to trust with my hair either live far away or are no longer doing hair, or you know, and so then you have to go through the process of finding somebody new, and it's like finding a new therapist. You know, it's kind of traumatic, and you have to retell your story, and sometimes you just don't want to do it. And so that's really the activity that I avoid. And then the thing that I can't avoid, but that I still am very self-conscious about, is if I'm teaching in front of a large group and I have done my best to do my hair, which for me, I've got really thin, fine hair and it's oily. And so I have to wash it every day and it looks better straight, but you know, that's a whole thing. And so I'm very self-conscious about my hair, about how my hair looks because it's not full. It will never be full. You know, it wasn't full when I was before I started pulling, and then after pulling and damage to your hair follicles, it ain't gonna be full ever in my life. And so for me, that's the self-consciousness of being, let's say I'm teaching at a women's conference, you know, which I did in January of this year. And there's a room full of 200 women who have gorgeous hair and it's curly or it's wavy or it's natural and it's beautiful. And it might be, you know, it might be up and maybe some folks have had it professionally done and maybe some folks, you know, don't get it professionally done, but it's just gorgeous. And so that's when I start to feel really self-conscious is, you know, then I'll start like kind of messing with it and, you know, wanting to touch it and move it around to try to keep it looking full, knowing that it's just never going to look that way. It's just not, you know, not what I've been given and certainly not what I have based on my BFRB.
How would you say your relationship with your BFRB has changed?
You know, my mother's no longer living. And so when she was living, she was always very slap my hand. Don't do that. That's unladylike, even when I was in my mid-30s, which is when she passed away. And so I think I feel less shame about it. My husband is, if he sees me do it, he's very gentle in his correction. He doesn't shame, he doesn't yell, he doesn't shout. He just gives me like a little nudge and reminder. Hey, hey, are you aware right now that you're pulling? Because we were talking about the trick trance, right? And I might not even be aware of it. And so there's definitely less shame about it, even talking about it here with you right now. It's like the more you talk, like secrecy fuels shame, right? It just does, whether we're talking about trauma or abuse or BFRBs. And so the more you can put light on it and get rid of that secrecy, it's like it doesn't have as much power. And that's what I'm learning over the decades about BFRBs.
I think now would be a great time to transition into talking about Between Two Trailers. I mean, it is, I'm like speechless when I talk about it. You are a beautiful writer. I mean, I have all your other books,
Thank
but
you. Wow.
you have a beautiful way with words and with sharing your experience. It is incredibly powerful. Oh my gosh, like really a really powerful book. How did it feel? And before even that part, we'll get to the how did it feel, but what led you to want to share so much about your experience? I mean, it's beautiful, it's intense. There's so many themes that are working through it. It's your life. And what made you want to share that with the world?
Oh, thank you. I write to figure things out. That's how I process everything in my life, and there's no exception to that. And so I knew when I was 36 and my mother had just died and my father had been dead since 2010, I knew that I needed to process my early childhood trauma as it pertained to them. And so both of my parents were very mentally unwell. My father was schizophrenic and my mother had personality disorders. And I grew up in a trailer with them in Western Indiana where they trafficked drugs to make ends meet. Because even though they were both college educated, their mental illnesses prevented them from holding down jobs and sort of being high functioning adults, even though they were very capable and smart and had lots of resources to do it. And so for me, with both of them gone, I knew that if I wanted to move forward in my life as an orphan, right, which we are all orphaned at some point, we all lose our parents. I needed to make sense of what my life with them had been like so that I could get some closure. Although I'm not sure that we ever have full closure on early childhood trauma, but the idea is that, again, that sort of going back to the BFRB is that secrecy fuels shame. And so I knew that if I didn't talk about my trauma with them, my early childhood as a drug dealer, as a child of drug dealers, that I was never going to get a grasp on the ways in which my trauma was showing up in my adult life, including patterns of behavior and including these BFRBs.
And you talk a lot about your trichotillomania. Was that a conscious decision? Like, I'm definitely including this? Because I know sometimes people will later admit to BFRBs, they're not comfortable at first, and then will
Right.
show. How did this go for you?
That's a great question. And I think I could have even done more. Although you showed me your dog-eared books and you showed me your copy of Between Two Trailers and how many instances of trick there were in that book. And there's a lot of marked pages in your book, which makes me feel better. It makes me feel like we actually, did it some justice in talking about it. But there's so much more I could have said and so much more I need to say about recovery from BFRBs recovery is active. It's not passive tense. But I felt like we had to mention it because for me, it was important to show people that the behaviors you see in children, teenagers, and adults, particularly behaviors that are unhealthy or maladaptive or dangerous, come from somewhere. They stem from pain or emotion or feelings or trauma. And so for me, my trick was an outward, visible sign of an inward, invisible to other people, turmoil of trauma. And so for me, it was important to include it to show people and to teach people that this is one way trauma can show up in people that you know. And so, again, creating awareness about it.
You did have a lot of instances, and I love that. Every time I'm like, yes.
Yay.
Were there
Good.
parts of the story that you knew you wanted to include, but they felt heavy in the moment? Like, it was one of those things where it's like, all right, I know I want to write about this. I'm going to push that off, though. I'm not emotionally ready to dive in.
Oh, yes, so many. Really, the whole book. But especially, there's a chapter in the book where my father is having a psychotic break from his schizophrenia. And I'm alone with him in our trailer in Western Indiana, and he has completely ripped the trailer apart, searching for government bugs. He had a paranoia with his schizophrenia, and we are alone together, and he is suicidal, and he's telling me that he's going to commit suicide. And there's lots of other things going on in this chapter. There's abuse, there's, sexual inappropriateness, there's sexual abuse, and there's all this trauma that sort of comes together in this culmination of this chapter, which is called King Unhinged. And it's like the pivotal part. And it was the hardest chapter to write, A, because you have to go back to a memory that is very traumatic and very uncomfortable. And then B, you got to sit with it in the present moment and write through it. And so I remember distinctly working on that chapter and all my BFRBs like coming to a head. Like I would have been working on this in early 2022, so at the tail end of the pandemic. So I'm pulling hair, I'm ripping cuticles, I'm biting nails, I'm doing knuckle popping, which we haven't talked about that yet. I'm struggling with my food addiction, which I have a food addiction. I'm in food addiction recovery. All these things are coming to a head, and I realize it's because I'm writing this very traumatic chapter. And one of the things that I did to cope with this, obviously, is write through it because it's the way that I process it. But one of the things I did years ago in late 2009 to cope with some of this early childhood trauma is a therapeutic method called EMDR, which I can't even remember what all those letters stand for. But it's using eye movements to help people recover from a very specific traumatic event in their any time in their lives. And the eye movements are designed to redirect and fix the neural pathways so that you can return to the traumatic event in a safe therapeutic environment, like with a therapist, right, who's guiding you. You're safe, you're not being exposed to trauma unnecessarily, but the trauma therapist helps you walk through that scene, which is exactly the scene that is in this King Unhinged chapter. And has you move your eyes back and forth as you're telling the scene in order to fix or recover those neural pathways. And it did help. It really did help. It led to sort of a domino effect of some other decisions. But that was one of the, like you said, I mean, just writing the book as a whole, but that chapter in particular, getting through that traumatic event of being at home alone with my father amid all that abuse, amid active suicide threats. Amid active harm, getting through all of that, writing it down, and being very aware of my BFRBs as I was writing that in early 2022 was essential for me. And even getting the manuscript finished, there were moments when I thought, I need to put this computer away, and I'm not sure I'm ever going to be able to return to this. But I think, like all recovery, right? It's one day at a time. It's one day at a time for a reason. And we know that. We know that sometimes it's 1 hour at a time. Sometimes it's one 15-minute block at a time, whatever it takes. And so for me, that was a time when I realized this trauma smoothie of all these things in this blender is really intense. And I need to take care of myself in this moment.
When you are writing moments for your younger self, whether that's college you or preschool you, being able to look back at that, Dana, were you able to almost kind of have a conversation with her and say, like, okay, you did your best at that time, like be able to relive those moments through their eyes, but yet also as the adult say, okay, I was kind of hard on myself, almost heal your inner child by writing through it.
That's it. Heal your inner child. That's it. So much of this book, so much of, Between Two Trailers is about integrating these two very disparate parts of myself, whether it's my father's daughter and my mother's daughter, who are really two completely different daughters that they each wanted, or whether it's the young Dana, who my father nicknamed me Budgie, or the adult Dana, who my mother nicknamed me Revy, short for Reverend. But healing this inner child, taking care of that little girl, and telling her it's gonna be okay. It doesn't feel like it's gonna be okay in the moment, right? And I think that's what, coming full circle, I think that's what BFRBs do for us. I would love to hear your perspective on this. They give our body and our brain something to do in the moment
that in a huge way offers us comfort and control in the moment. When we don't have control over anything out here in the environment, especially as little kids, we do have control over this right hand coming up to our hair and doing the twist, pop, pull that gives the brain and the body relief in that moment. You know, I think that's really what BFRBs are all about. And I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
No, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's beautifully said. I think it's so true. You know, we are little kids. We don't know how to process these things that are happening around us. And our body's like, I got you. I know what to do. It's
I
not a
know what to do.
choice. It was just our
Right.
body said, this will work, and I'm gonna do this for you. And we were like, great, because I need some support. And this is what we got.
This is what we got. Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yes. So well said.
Who was the first person you showed your manuscript to?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. My agent, Mark Tauber, who is amazing, the most extraordinary agent who got me the book contract with Penguin Random House. He was the first person that saw really a huge chunk of the manuscript, along with my editor, Karen Baltzer. And my husband has seen parts of it, but he confesses that he really has he hasn't read the whole thing. And I think because it is such a difficult, intense read for him. And I think he feels such a kinship and it, you know, with me, obviously, but also feels like he is my advocate. And it makes him very angry to think about sort of the position that I was put in as a child. And so it's hard for him. He's so close, up close, and personal with it. And he has not read it. But these two folks who are professionals, my agent and my editor, who I trust with, you know, with these words and with my career, they were the first to read it, you know, and they were very supportive and encouraged me to be brave and to keep writing it and to keep editing it. And you know, both of them, Mark and Karen, said, we're gonna get this right, and we're gonna publish it. And it's going to help a lot of people who maybe have very different circumstances from the Between Two Trailers, you know, specifics of being born and raised in a drug trafficking family. But the themes of families and life being universally complicated and trauma being all around us are something that affect all of us. All of us can point to some specific complication within our family of origin or even family of choice in relationships, in addictions, and BFRBs. We can point to some traumatic instance in our life, whether it was a one-time event or a chronic event. All of us can, in some way, relate to this manuscript and sort of, and that's what Mark and Karen taught me when they read it for the first time. They were very reassuring.
Was there a part that you wanted to remove that they said, no, let's keep this in? Like, this is an important one.
Oh, I think that King Unhinged chapter, I was hesitant about even writing it. Mark was the first to say, you need to write this chapter and you need to write it real and honest and you need to tell everything, right? And we took out a few parts of it so that the reader could keep reading because there is a line for the reader. Like we realized that there is a line where if the reader keeps reading and it's too much and it's too traumatic, the reader, especially in the case of sexual abuse, is going to slam the book shut and not even go to part two and say, this situation is irredeemable and I cannot read anymore, right? All of us have that threshold. And so we were very true in the King Unhinged chapter. We were true to the facts. We were true to the experience. And both Karen and Mark said that this was a necessary chapter and we had to have it in. It was very traumatic, obviously, to write and very traumatic for the reader to read. And we just took out a very few things that we knew would be the point of no return. Anything that we felt like the reader was not going to be able to keep moving and keep reading, we took it out. But really, that it boiled down to really just one core sentence, to be honest with you. The rest of it is in there and it's real.
When you knew this was going to be published, were there people in your life, whether it's close family members or just people you knew in high school, were there people that you were like, oh, I don't really know if I want them to read it? You know, something like that, where it's like, strangers may be okay, but someone who knows me, I'm not sure.
That's a great distinction. Yeah, it's very interesting to have strangers give you praise for your book or critique for your book, you know, either one, and even middle ground. But yeah, when people you know and love read the book, and it was that moment of, oh my goodness, like what are the people I love the most in the world gonna think about this book? And or what are the people I've no am and no longer in contact with, you know, thinking about some college friends, but with whom I had a very painful experience, what are they gonna think about the book? And so I did my best to be true to the story, but also be sensitive and cognizant that there are living characters out there in the world who would have to read the book and or have people come up to them and tell them, hey, I saw that you're in this book, or I read about you in this book, you know. And that's especially true for my family of origin. You know, people contact them all the time and say, oh, you're in this book, I read about you, and what do you think of it, and all this stuff. So I really tried to be sensitive to that, knowing that people were going to come up to them and, you know, maybe force them to talk about some things they didn't want to talk about. So we try to handle all that very delicately and with sensitivity, but also remain true to the story. Because at the end of the day, you know, Karen, my editor, and Mark, my agent, reminded me all the time, this is your story. This is no one else's story. It's your story to tell.
I remember looking at an interview with the woman who wrote Educated, and she had written about her family. And when it was published, members of her family were trying to say that it wasn't accurate. Oh, it didn't happen like that, didn't happen like that. Was there that fear for you that maybe people that were in your family would have a similar response?
Absolutely. And one of the ways I mitigated that is, you know, I'm a wannabe lawyer. I've always wanted to be a lawyer. That's no secret. That's in the book. I was going to be a lawyer. And so I put on my lawyer hat and I said, okay, what would a lawyer do? A lawyer would try to corroborate every single one of these stories with some evidence, right? And so early on in the manuscript, I began collecting court records, military records, psychiatric records. I read letters. I did deep dives into photographs. I did interviews with folks who wanted to remain anonymous, but I have the transcripts of their interviews and have their permission, obviously, to interview them. And so I used everything I could, all the tools in my toolbox, to corroborate this story against my own memory, right? Because memory can be faulty. Although one thing I did learn about trauma is that you, in many ways, you can trust your memory when it comes to trauma, but it's important to corroborate it if you're writing a book about it and you're writing about other people in particular. And so, yeah, I put on my lawyer hat and I said, what's the evidence? You know, if I'm going to tell this story, I need to have evidence that it actually happened and that I'm getting the details correct. And so that was one thing that I did that really worked out in the end, because then people have said, you got that right. And you got that right because you did the research, you did the legwork, you listened to us when we were telling stories and when you were interviewing us. And so that felt really good, you know, that folks for the most part have said, you know, you got it right.
I feel like my trauma, some people's trauma, it blanks their mind. Mine, I feel like I remember every single thing of every moment of every. My trauma is so much inside, and like I just open my eyes and it's right there. Is that the same way for you?
Yes, my trauma is so vivid. And yes, you're right. Some people do have the body and brain protects them, right? And they have sort of a disassociation and everything goes blank. I'm the opposite. I remember every little detail and verbatim and what was said and what's happening in the environment. And so for me, that is how my trauma brain works. I don't know that one is more beneficial than the other, right? Is it better to remember it, or is it better to have a blank space? Who knows, right? I think the issue with the blank space would be maybe that I would doubt myself, you know, when it came to my own trauma, and or maybe I couldn't learn from it as much, right? Because I couldn't remember precisely what was happening and the pain and the emotion that I felt that may be leading to the patterns and behaviors that I'm having right now, you know, in the present day. And so yes, mine has always been very vivid. Yeah, and I can still see scenes and colors and textures and people and what they look like, what they smelled like, and what they said. So yeah, mine is vivid as well.
When this becomes a movie,
Oh, you're
who
so kind. You're so gracious.
who would you like to play you? If not you, who would you like to play you?
Oh my gosh. You know, I don't think about myself in this story that's so bizarre. It's so, but folks have asked me that. And I love that question because A, it's so hopeful and gracious and, and may someone find it, right? And have a vision to make it into a movie or a TV show. That would be amazing because that just means that more people will be exposed to the story and therefore, it might touch them in their lives in some way. But I have no idea who would play me. I know whom I would like to play my parents, right? I've thought about that a lot. Anne Hathaway is spot on, spitting image of my beauty pageant mother when she was young. Brown eyes, dark hair, beautiful porcelain skin, gaunt, beauty queen collarbone and figure. And then my father had more of the Oscar Isaac look. He had olive skin. Oscar Isaac had the best beard game I think I've ever seen in Hollywood in a film or in on TV. And so he really is. My father, King, is a spitting image, or Oscar Isaac is a spitting image of my father. And so, but for me, I have no idea. Do you have ideas for who, what would be a good fit? I'm just so curious.
Well, I'm loving, I don't know if it's a recency bias, but I'm loving the girl who played Alicent Hightower, the younger one in House of the Dragon.
Oh,
Let me show you.
ooh,
Because
ooh,
she has
yes.
this like beautiful, here, I'll show you. I'll actually share my screen.
Oh,
Let's
good.
see.
Yay. I'm gonna see this. Oh my gosh.
Like her with dark hair, like
Whoa. Whoa. Oh my
have her hair
gosh.
match
Okay.
you.
Emily Carey. That's who this is. Oh my gosh, Barbara. That's amazing. Oh, I love it. Oh gosh. I can't wait to show Fred. That's amazing. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Of
Thank
course.
you. Whoa.
She is, and you know what's even cooler too? Not only is she fantastic, she has a BFRB in the show.
No way.
Picks the skin
Oh,
off her nail.
yes. Okay, the dermatillomania.
And I think she'd be fantastic as teenage you. Of
wow. That's so cool. Thank you. Thank you so
course.
much.
What advice would you give someone who wants to share their story just like you?
Start with people you trust. You asked me the question earlier about who had seen the manuscript first. And I think that's really important. And for me, it was my agent and my editor. So start with people you trust, because just going full circle in our conversation, you and I started this conversation by looking at, when BFRBs first show up in children or teenagers or adults, what is the reaction of people around you, right? And most of the time, it's not a great reaction. People don't know, or they're frightened, or they think it's weird, or, gross, or whatever it is. And so share it with someone you trust first, someone who's going to offer you a judgment-free zone, right? That might be a coach, it might be a therapist, or in our case, you and I, it was online community. You opened the door for me, and I didn't even know that this existed, that people were talking about it. And so trust is paramount, because I think if you share it with in an environment or in a situation where people are not going to have a pleasant, not a pleasant, but a empathetic reaction, that can be really damaging. And in some way it can be traumatic in and of itself, and then cause you to double down on your BFRB. So someone you trust is paramount.
What do you think young Dana would say, knowing who you are now?
She would say to me, breathe, take a deep breath. And you are stronger than you think. Those two things. Yeah. And that has turned out to be true. Take a deep breath. A deep breath can solve a lot of different things. And most of us, all of us, are stronger than we think, right? Stronger than we give ourselves credit for.